let me start by saying something about the unique place that mathematics has in human knowledge. It has the unique place, one of the ways the place is unique is that mathematics is the most certain and least controversial of human areas of knowledge. But it is also among the areas where we know least what we're talking about. So if you do geology, well, you're talking about rocks and continents and things like that. And it seems like you have a pretty clear picture of what sort of things you're talking about. You can even point them out. Similarly, for chemistry and biology, it's fairly clear what your subject matter is. What are those objects you are studying? The same is true of non-fundamental physics. It is sort of physics of medium-scale objects. In those cases, we know what we're talking about. In mathematics, we don't, and the other area where we really don't is fundamental physics. We have very little idea of what it is that we're talking about, what, say, the Schrödinger equation describes. But in these areas, geology, chemistry, biology, and the like, even though we're much clearer on what we're talking about, we are much less certain that what we're saying is true than we are in mathematics. We're much more liable to make mistakes. Much of the sciences of, say, 2,000 years ago have been disproved. But what has been mathematics 2,000 years ago more or less stands, sometimes with minor corrections. Euclid forgot a few axioms. Those have been filled in the 20th century. But apart from minor corrections, it seems like the edifice of ancient mathematics stands. We have, for instance, known since the time of the ancient Greeks things like that there are infinitely many prime numbers. But we still have very little idea what numbers are, and hence what prime numbers are. We know it's easy to distinguish prime numbers from other numbers, but to know what numbers are is, of course, extremely puzzling in a way in which it is not in the puzzling what the subject matter of, say, biology is. So we've got this unique combination of uncontroversial near certainty and deep mystery. So I'm going to move from these. This is not a mathematics talk, so we're not going to have this uncontroversial near certainty. We're going to have highly controversial uncertainty, a very speculative thinking about these matters. There's a famous joke that some of you have no doubt heard about the dean who is talking to the physicist. The physicist had just asked for a lot of money for a lab. And the dean says, "Why can't you be like the mathematician? The mathematician only needs paper, pencil, and a garbage can." No. Better yet, why don't you be like the philosopher? They don't even need the garbage can. So I am a philosopher now. And I sympathize with this. Like my first semester of real research in math, at the end of every week for a whole semester, my desk was filled with notes, all of which were garbage, and all of which went into the garbage, and I made no progress over a semester. I have not had a similar experience in philosophy. Now, is this because I'm way better at philosophy, or is it that our standards are way lower, and so we don't know what to throw out? It's not clear to me. Notice, though, that both my experience and the joke show that the near certainty of mathematics doesn't mean that we don't make mistakes in it, right? It's more that it is relatively easy to detect the mistakes with careful thought. I would initially maybe not notice them and then later notice them or just notice that it's a fruitless approach. And of course, your math professors are good at noticing your mistakes on tests. But the field as a whole has an fairly uncontroversial grasp on the truth of many things.
because things have been checked out in a way which we do not have in the sciences. So it's nearly certain, deeply mysterious, and at the same time extremely practically useful, and often highly non-trivial. You know, there's some things that you can be quite certain of that are pretty trivial, like that you are yourself. Yeah, but that's pretty trivial. But mathematics is nearly certain, often, and yet non-trivial. Okay. So that's one aspect of the uniqueness of mathematics. So there
are many theories in philosophy about the nature of mathematics. And they kind of divide into two camps. One camp is a Platonic camp. So this goes back to Plato, back in the 4th century BC. And Plato argued that besides our physical world, there is a world of abstract objects. These abstract objects, he thought, were really real. They're not just creations of our minds. They're not just things in our imagination. They're really real. The physical world is not perfect. It doesn't have the kinds of things that mathematics talks about. Mathematics talks about circles, triangles, and lines. The real world only has stuff like that, and that's not a circle, not a triangle, and not a line segment. Unless the topology is really weird. the metric. So the physical world has only imperfection. And Plato thought, but there's got to be something for these mathematics to be about. And other things. He wanted to extend this to other things like goodness and beauty and other things like that, which also the world doesn't have in its perfect form. So he thought, there must be these things, these abstract objects. He wouldn't use the word abstract. That he calls forms or ideas. In that world, we've got the genuine article that the things in this world merely imitate. This thing reminds us of a perfect circle which lives in the Platonic heaven, which is kind of not his terminology. It's not a place. It's a way of being that is not material. And in the Platonic world, we can have all the stuff of mathematics existing in some kind of non-physical, non-material way. You can have numbers, circles, lines, and all the stuff that more recent mathematics has, like sets, categories, vector space, manifolds, division rings, and all that kind of cool stuff. And it can have it for real. So this is great. It answers the question of what mathematics is about. And it makes it seem like this is cool. The mathematics is getting us into this Platonic world. But there are puzzles about this. And I want to focus on three puzzles with this. The first puzzle is, what are these strange entities? I mean, so we've said what they're not. They're not physical. They're not imperfect. They don't exist in space and time, we can add, and things like that. But we're still really unclear. What are these mathematical objects? And we have more of an answer of what they're not than what they are from the Platonic picture. The second question, and this is one that 20th century philosophy of mathematics has struggled with in connection with Platonic views, quite a bit, is, look, we are evolved apes. How do we, who are evolved apes, have access to this realm of non-physical objects? I mean, we know how we have access to the realm of physical objects. Light bounces off them and hits the retina, and it generates electrical signals that go to the brain and all that stuff. We hear sounds. But these are non-physical objects. How on earth are beings on Earth able to get access to them and know about them with near certainty, even? It's not even some foggy way. Like, we are more sure that there are infinitely many primes than we are of many things that we know through our senses.
because our senses can often go wrong. I mean, maybe I'm dreaming. But if I've got the proof that there are infinitely many primes in front of me, it's just there, hard to deny. So how do we have this access to these strange non-physical entities? And then the third question is one that Plato didn't ask so much, because in his time it wasn't so clear that the mathematics was immensely useful, though it was somewhat useful already. Why is studying these non-physical objects at all useful for studying the physical world around us? That's very puzzling. I mean, why would these things have any bearing on this physical world here? Okay. The other approach is sort of, it's more of a broad family of approaches. I'm going to give two of them. If you know more philosophy and mathematics, there's a good chance I've left out the ones you like more, and we can talk about those during the discussion. Deflationary theories of mathematics are philosophical theories that make mathematics less mysterious and more accessible to apes. I think that's actually a pretty charitable way of putting it, and it explains the apes, the goals that the apes that put forward these theories have, fellow apes of ours. One that was very popular in the beginning of the 20th century is logicism. The idea is that mathematics is about logic, and mathematics is the study of what can be proved from axioms. So Euclid, when he gave his geometry about 2,500 years ago, started with a whole bunch of axioms and then proved a whole bunch of stuff from them. There are a few axioms that he left unstated that he used implicitly, but basically he was just proving things from axioms. Those axioms, they describe a flat, as we call it, Euclidean space. That's not the kind of space we've got in our universe, but it doesn't matter, because what mathematics is about is it's not about describing what the geometry of our world is like or anything like that, or even what the geometry in the Platonic world is like. It's about describing what follows from the axioms, and what Euclid said follows from the axioms does in fact follow from them if you make the minor revisions that are necessary. And if you change the axioms, other things will follow. And that's all mathematics is doing. It does not care if the axioms we start off with are true or false. This makes mathematics unmysterious. We don't have to answer the question, what are numbers, for instance, because we can just say, look, here's mathematics, just purely hypothetical. If there are things that behave according to the axioms of arithmetic, then the following is true. We don't have to know, is there anything that actually satisfies these axioms? We just have to give these kind of logical if-then claims. It's accessible to us because we can do proofs. And it's applicable, which is interesting, because the axioms might, in fact, apply not just to things out in the Platonic heaven, but they might apply to things in the real world. Things in the real world might satisfy the axioms. The space of our the space here, approximately at least, satisfies Euclid's axioms. And if you change them to some other axioms, it may exactly satisfy them. And so that kind of what follows from the axioms is then going to be either approximately or exactly true for us. So it makes sense of why mathematics is applicable. And it seems like this mysterious mathematical objects like numbers and sets and all these things have been replaced with just what can be proved. This view largely collapsed, or much of the support for it collapsed, due to the logician Kurt Gödel's work in the 1930s. Without going into the detail here, what I think Gödel's work showed is that the idea of proof is just as puzzling and mysterious as the idea of a number. I mean, you can actually think of a proof as a mathematical object. It's a sequence of statements, a sequence of symbols. That's abstract. If we're looking for things that are provable, we're still looking for the existence of seemingly abstract objects, namely proofs. And that is just as mysterious as the numbers. And in fact, Gödel showed ways of going back and forth from between talking about proofs and talking about numbers. And so it seems like we've got the mystery that we try to get rid of is still there. We still need axioms for proofs, actually. And not just axioms that proofs start with, but axioms for what constitutes a proof. The other approach, and this is a very old one, actually. I think one can see bits of it in Thomas Aquinas, for instance, and Aristotle, maybe. It's always a very popular view, is the view that mathematics is mind-dependent. It's talking about things in our minds. Mathematical entities are something like things we create with our minds, like Sherlock Holmes. This, again, makes mathematics unmysterious and accessible to us, because if we've created it, we have access to it. But it's puzzling now why it's objective. Seems like mathematics is like the height of objectivity. You know, if you go to talks in various departments, the culture is different. If you go to a philosophy talk, there will be a big fight after it. People will argue and ask questions, which are really counter-arguments. You never see that, or maybe almost never, when you go to math talk. Math, it seems like we've got this kind of, at least, intersubjectivity, this agreement. There will be questions about how you could take this work further. Could there be maybe a simpler proof? But not. There isn't a questioning of what the author has said. Maybe, unless they've really screwed up. And I've gone to a number of conferences. I've never actually seen that happen. The worst I've seen was somebody's work had already been done by someone else, which was sad. But it was still right. So the mind-dependent thing is puzzling, right? Because you would think, okay, so I make up Sherlock Holmes, you make up Hercule Poirot, how is it that in mathematics we all have the same set of concepts? Okay. So so we've got sort of deflationary theories have their problems, Platonic theories have their problems. I want to throw another thing into the mix, which is that mathematics is beautiful. Which is something that usually philosophers of mathematics, I think, don't talk that much about. They're more interested in these deep metaphysical questions. If you're not already convinced that mathematics has a beauty in it, I'm probably not going to convince you. Not everybody is aware of this beauty. Just like not everybody is aware of the beauty of math, or not everybody perceives the beauty of mathematics, just as not everybody perceives the beauty of music. I, for instance, barely perceive the beauty of music. I know that the works of Beethoven are sublimely beautiful, but I know this because people I trust say so. I do not, in fact, I am just mildly annoyed by really just about any... My reactions to music range from indifference to mild annoyance to major annoyance. Beethoven is somewhere in the mild annoyance. My favorite piece of music is 4:33 because it's 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence. But I know that that's not actually the best piece of music. I know it's not actually as beautiful as the works of Beethoven, and I know this because people I trust say so. And I think the same can be true of mathematics for those of us who do not have the same kind of perception of the beauty of mathematics. But I'll give you some, you know, pretty pictures, right? There are, I think, at least three different kinds of beauty in mathematics. So one kind is that there are mathematical objects, like, you know, sets, or functions in this case, that are beautiful and are generated by simple rules. It's easy to get, you know, you can get whatever you like if you want. If your rule is complicated, you can get the Mona Lisa with a mathematical formula, but it's going to be an extremely complicated formula. What's interesting, I think, are the ones where you get these really beautiful objects generated by a simple rule. And a lot, fractals give a lot of examples of this sort of thing. You get other kinds of things. Not all of it is visual. There are some mathematical objects that are beautiful without being being visually beautiful. You know, the automorphism group of the Octonians is a great thing, but it's not something that, you know, unless you've got incredible high dimensional visualization skills, it's not visually beautiful. And while the pictures sort of grab people, I think a lot of mathematicians will also think of the beauty of these kinds of non-visual things. The second kind of mathematical beauty, and I think this is really cool, is some mathematical facts are really beautiful. Like, you know, sort of you hear some theorem, you think this is really cool and beautiful. This, any Euclidean triangle, its angles add up to the same thing. And you know, when you first hear it, this is really amazing. You try to look for counterexamples, you think, maybe it's really thin. Oh, but then this one's close to 180, and these don't add much to it. Maybe it's like this. Well, then they're all close to 60, and that it's up to 180. You pretty soon convince yourself, well, it's going to be at least close to that. But it's really surprising initially, and it's kind of a beautiful fact about triangles. Every natural number can be uniquely written as a product of primes. That's really neat. polynomials of degree n have n zeros, counting multiplicities, and only over the complex field. Every non-commutative division ring is infinite. There are only 5 platonic solids. That one, the last one, is really beautiful. I mean, you'd think there would be infinitely many initially, or zero. A platonic solid is one where, you know, all the faces are this... and all the corners are the same. The cube is one, the tetrahedron is one, and there are 3 others. You might have initially thought that there will be infinitely many. You can just progress up. Cube, tetrahedron, made out of triangles, cube made up of squares, and something that, then things made out of pentagons, and then... But no, wait, it stops after only 5 examples. That's really kind of beautiful, I think. And the third kind of beauty, which I think is the one that I think a lot of mathematicians are particularly sensitive to, is the beauty of mathematical proofs. So one of the great discoveries of ancient mathematics was that there are infinitely many primes. And the proof is, this is just a gorgeous little proof that in high school math. There are only finitely many primes, then there's going to be a biggest prime. We could list all the primes, then p1 through pn. You can multiply them all together and then add 1. And this thing you get by multiplying together all the primes and adding 1 is not going to be divisible by any prime number, because it's going to have remainder 1 when you divide it by any prime, because the product of all the primes plus 1. So it's not divisible by any prime, so it itself is a prime. But it's bigger than the biggest prime because it's the product of all the primes plus 1. So if you assume that there is a biggest prime, you quickly get yourself into a contradiction. It's, I think, a lovely proof, and there are many lovely mathematical proofs. Mathematicians talk of proofs from the book sometimes. The mathematician Erdős came up with this phrase, and the idea is that you're supposed to imagine like God has this book of the best mathematical proofs, and when you've really got it, you found the one that God's got in his book. And maybe this is one of those. There's probably a way to put it even more neatly than that, but it's pretty close to the one that's in the book. And at the same time, not all proofs are like that. Some are pretty ugly. I've produced a lot of those. Okay, so mathematics is beautiful. Explanations of this phenomenon. Again, theories as to why this is so. Again, I'll just go through 2 representative ones. The first one is the beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Very common view in our culture, that beauty is just subjective. We have different, it's just a matter of taste. It's something like what you find yourself pleased in an aesthetic way by. That's just false. Beauty is not in the eye of the beholder. Look, if your eye tells you this is as beautiful as this, you're you need no glasses. I actually spent 15 minutes making the drawing on today. You can see what... Okay, I do need the garbage can. So I think it's just false that beauty's in the eye of the beholder. But suppose it's even true. Let's suppose for the sake of argument it's true. There's still a puzzle. Why did we evolve to find mathematics beautiful? So, you know, the beautiful, the pleasure we take in the beautiful is not just any pleasure. It's different from the pleasure we take in food. It's different from the pleasure people take in sex. It's a different kind of pleasure. Why do we have that kind of pleasure? And why do we find it in mathematics? I don't think our ancient forebears perceived mathematical beauty once we go far enough back. Probably didn't have words for numbers. They might have seen things that are beautiful, sunsets and lions and things like that, but not, I think, mathematical things. So, since they didn't perceive mathematical beauty, perceiving mathematical beauty didn't help them gain mates or survive. But that's how things evolve, it seems, by helping gain mates or survive. At best, the perception of mathematical beauty is what biologists call a spandrel. It's this thing that isn't selected for its own sake, that doesn't aid in the passing on of genes, but happens to be a concomitant of things that do, in fact, help. It's a side effect of things that do, in fact, help. So it may be you could have this kind of a story. An enjoyment of physical beauty in other human beings is useful to recognition of health in other human beings. For instance, symmetry is an important character, part of our perception of beauty. Things, people who are more symmetric, we tend to see as more beautiful, other things being equal. Maybe there's a kind of connection between symmetry and health. And health, of course, is a sign of good genetics to some degree. And so maybe if you choose your mates on the basis of beauty, they are going to be, your offspring will be healthier and hence more likely to survive. And so a perception of the beauty of other human beings might help you survive. There may be some other things. A lot of this is going to be highly speculative. You know, you kind of wonder, maybe the smells of ripe fruits, the beauty of those smells attracts us to eat the good ones and avoid the bad ones, which again could help us survive. But the appreciation of mathematical stuff doesn't do anything like that, or didn't when human beings were, when the kinds of evolutionary processes were going on. Sure, we've sort of perceived mathematical beauty for the last couple thousand years, but that's just not long enough to, I think, have had much evolutionary effect. So it seems the best to be something just sort of this side effect. And I wonder, though, if it's just this kind of biologically unimportant side effect, is there really any point to this pleasure? Is devoting one's life to finding more beautiful proofs any different from devoting one's life to drugs? I mean, it has fewer side effects, so that's a plus. But, you know, presumably eventually, people will find ways of giving us jolts of pleasure without side effects as well. So I worry that the subjectivist account, it's got problems just because subjectivism, I think, about beauty is false, but also I think it leads to devaluing the mathematical pursuits. And it leaves unanswered this question, which is why beautiful mathematics is useful. And I will say more about that in a bit. The second explanation, and this one I think there seems to me to be a lot to this one, and I think I'm not completely convinced this one doesn't work. And if it does work, it weakens some of the theses of the rest of this talk. And the thought is this: the vast majority of mathematical objects, facts, and proofs are not beautiful. You have a little hex set up, and you arrange the hexes at random. Most of the time, you'll just get stuff like that. Very rarely, you'll get something lovely like that. In fact, I did not get this by arranging them randomly. I did this by running a cellular automaton with some rules. But the vast majority of mathematical objects, facts, and proofs are not beautiful. You examine math journals, most of the proofs are not that pretty. There's tons of mathematical facts that are ugly. Take two 10-digit numbers at random, multiply them together, you get a 20-digit number. That the product of these two is equal to that one is a fact, but it doesn't seem to be at all beautiful. You can prove that fact, too, by using the distributive law a lot. Again, the proof's going to be really long and ugly, too. We seek out the beautiful ones. We're like rock collectors. There are many ugly rocks, but we find the few that are beautiful out there. I'm attracted to some degree to this view, but there are some puzzles that I think it still leaves open. One, if it's really all that rare, how do we manage to find it? Well, maybe that's not that rare. I don't know. You need some kind of balance in this story. Because if the beauty is too common, then we still have a puzzle as to why it's that common. And if it's really rare, then we have a puzzle that as to how we manage to come across it so much and so well. Maybe there's some kind of sweet spot where it's just rare enough that maybe it's like with rocks, maybe we have a sweet spot too. We can actually find some beautiful ones. But still, it's a bit of a puzzle. Second puzzle, and I think this is a really interesting one. Why is there any non-sensory beauty? So in my mathematical examples, the first bunch of things were mathematical objects that we can visualize nicely. Those are beautiful in a sensory kind of way, namely their representations on a screen or on paper are beautiful. But then we came to some purely abstract stuff, like the V group G2 and proofs and mathematical facts. And those, I could write them in a pretty font and so on if I wanted to, but that's not what makes them beautiful. It's their content that makes them beautiful, and their content is abstract and non-visual. How is it that there's any beauty outside of the physical stuff? It seems, again, go back to the evolutionary picture, it seems like it's sensory beauty that we get benefits of being sensitive to. Why is there any non-sensory beauty like here? And the third one, and I want to go on to talk more about this question, why is beautiful mathematics particularly useful? You might wonder, is it? But I think it is. So let me talk about this. So I'm going to mention several figures throughout this talk. One of them here is Copernicus, marks a kind of turning point in science. Since his time, beautiful, elegant, and simple mathematical theories rule physics. I mean, not immediately, not everybody's convinced by Copernicus, but there is a kind of beauty and elegance to theories. We have Copernicus's lovely circular system at the front. It's actually not quite as lovely as it seems because they're epicycles, because that he had to add to make it work, because in fact the orbits are not circular, they're elliptical, and he didn't know that. But it's still fairly lovelier than the ones that other people had at that time. Then we go sort of beautifully simple equations. Some of them, the simplicity kind of hides a lot of complexity behind the scenes. but there's a kind of loveliness to it. Some of the lovely kind of facts, like mass and energy, are conserved. And this all has mathematical formulation. And so we've got such beautiful, elegant, simple mathematical theories, and they seem to rule physics. Now, here's something that philosophers of science worry a lot about, which is that simpler theories are never the best fit to the data. So, you know, I just sort of made up a couple of points, made sure they didn't lie exactly on the line, put them in red, and then you can get a curve, there were 5 points, so you can get a fourth degree polynomial that goes exactly through each of these points. But you can be pretty confident that whatever physical phenomenon, if these numbers actually came from some physical phenomenon, you can be pretty sure that this curve is not, in fact, the correct description of the physical phenomenon. I mean, you look at the red points and you ask yourself, if my input is zero, what will my output be? Surely not around 3. Surely not 3.13. But if you draw the polynomial through them, you're going to get that kind of thing. You could do a more complicated one, that'll be different. In fact, surely the right answer is something like pretty close to this straight line, y equals x, which is much simpler, more elegant, more beautiful, but doesn't fit the data as well. The data is better fitted by the nastier and uglier thing, but we still tend to go with the simpler thing, unless we really can't. So suppose we are confident, you know, if we read Newton's stuff and so on, in his time. Imagine somebody said to Newton, you know, this is a nice formula, but how do you know that the force isn't this? After all, you don't have measurements that are precise enough to tell the predictions apart for this and this. I mean, I don't know what effect that slight change in the exponent would make, but I'm quite sure that Newton did not have data sufficient to distinguish these two. But yet this would be a crazy suggestion that this is the truth, unless we had some specific evidence. But if all we have is data that fits this and this equally well, we go for this. And even if the data fits this just a slightly touch better, we still probably go for this one, because it's way simpler and more beautiful, more elegant. This could be just mere convenience, right? I mean, it's a nuisance when you do your calculations. You have to deal with all this, right? Maybe we just round it off to 2. Maybe it's an aesthetic preference. Maybe we just like it. It's pretty. We just want our physics textbooks to be full of pretty equations if we're physicists, because we're going to spend a lot of time with them. And so, of course, we want the things we want to spend our time with to be pretty. This is like a serious suggestion, actually, in the philosophy of science as to why scientific theories are beautiful. It's because people want to spend time on beautiful things. I don't think this is satisfactory. I think if this is true, we shouldn't trust science if it's just mere convenience or aesthetic preference. For then, why do we? Why should we go for the line instead of this? Why should we make our predictions on the basis of the line rather than this weird polynomial? And yet, I think we should trust science. So I think beautiful mathematics is useful because it describes the world. The mathematics of the straight line is more beautiful than mathematics of this particular polynomial, and is better at describing the world. There's this strange confluence between the beauty of the mathematics and its usefulness in describing the world. So now I want to... But why? Why is there this confluence? So that's another question I want to ask. So we have some questions about the nature of mathematics, why mathematics has beauty in it, and why this beauty seems to be connected with our science. So now I want to talk quickly about some answers from 3 Catholic thinkers who together, I think, give a nice account of the answers: St. Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas, and Galileo. So Augustine, 4th and 5th century AD. He wondered where the numbers were, what they were, what kind of things they were. He was highly influenced by Plato, but he had a different thought, a different idea, which is that he thought that Plato's forms, these non-physical things, they were ideas in the mind of God. In the mind of the infinite God. This kind of tamed the infinity of the numbers. The Greeks kind of found infinities threatening because their gods were finite, and so infinities looked bigger than their gods. Augustine's God was greater than any mathematical infinity. In fact, he said, in a way, mathematical infinities are really finite in comparison to God, he thought. His theory is kind of like the mind-dependent theory of mathematics. The mathematics is about thinking, but it's not about our thinking. It's about God's thinking, and that makes it objective. Because there's just one person, or maybe three if it's a Trinitarian God, whose thinking is relevant here. So I don't get to think my own mathematical thoughts, and you don't get to think different ones, because the thoughts need to match up with God's thoughts. And this kind of story, I think, yields answers to many of the questions we had before. What are these mathematical objects? They're ideas in the mind of God. This, I think, takes some of the mystery out. So we're kind of wondering, what are these non-physical objects in the Platonic heaven? We have no idea what they are. Well, ideas, thoughts, are something we have at least some grasp on. Now, granted, God is mysterious, but he's still a person. Maybe only in a somewhat analogical sense, but at least we have an analogy to ourselves. We are persons. We think. God thinks. We have some kind of axis. We have some kind of picture. We have some kind of idea of what God's ideas are, because they're at least analogical to our ideas. How do we know? How do we have access to these, to God's, to these mathematical objects? Well, here's a story you can tell, and I think this is Augustine's story. God knows his own ideas. Why? Well, they're his ideas, just like you know your own thinking. Maybe you don't always know what you're thinking. Sometimes we are confused. Sometimes we need a counselor's help. But God isn't confused about his own thinking in the same way. God always knows exactly what he's thinking. So God knows his own ideas. He creates intelligent beings in his image whose thinking matches these ideas. And so that's how we get access, by being created in the image and likeness of the God whose ideas the mathematics is about. That means that one of the reasons mathematics is worth doing is actually theological, in Augustine's view. It tells us something about God's mind. It tells us what he's thinking about. Not everything he's thinking about. He's thinking about non-mathematical things too, but at least some of the things he's thinking about. It gives us a story about why mathematics is beautiful. I mean, one of the things you see, I think, in all the religions is beauty, is a kind of connection between the supernatural and beauty. And in the Western religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the idea of God is that the idea of a being that is perfectly beautiful. And it makes at least some sense that that his ideas would therefore be beautiful. The mathematical abilities of humans are images of God and hence have a beauty to them. Now, this does raise a puzzle. What about the ugly mathematics? I said there's a lot of ugly mathematics out there. I don't know. Maybe it's part of larger undiscovered patterns yet that make beautiful in a larger context. I don't know. Why does our sense of the beautiful extend to mathematics? Well, we could say one thing is that it's useful. We still have to bracket as to why it's useful. But also we could say that finding beauty in non-physical things opens us up to the beauty of God. It's kind of hard for us to relate to how could our something that is not physical be really important to our lives. But if we have this recognition of mathematical truth as important to our lives and not being a non-physical, then the appreciation of beauty maybe helps open us up to appreciate God. We still have unanswered this question. Why does beautiful mathematics describe the universe? And time's getting short, so I think I'm going to very quickly say the thing about Aquinas before I get to that question of why it's useful. There's one of the puzzles that one can ask is why is it that logic gives us access to mathematics? It's especially a powerful question to ask if you think of mathematics about God's mind. Why is logic the right way to access things about God's mind? Why not poetry? Imagine mathematicians instead proceeding by poetry instead of by logic. I think it would work not quite so well. I don't think I'd want to fly in the airplane that was based on the poetic mathematics. So Thomas Aquinas has this idea that what is possible, what is logically possible, is made possible by God's power, and God's power extends only to the things that are logically coherent, and so logic is actually a study of God's power, Aquinas could say. God's mathematical ideas, you could think of as ideas about what God can create, what kind of arrangements of things God can create. So these fractals, for instance, there's nothing in the world that is fractal like that, but God could create something that is like that. So there's a kind of intertwining of logic and mathematics, because logic tells us about God's power, because God can do all the logically coherent things. Okay, but I want to go back to the question of why mathematics is useful and what this has to do with beauty. And this is Galileo's beautiful little quote. He says, philosophy, and here he means, I think, science. So let's say, science is written in this grand book, which stands continually open before our eyes. I say the universe. So the book is the universe. But cannot be understood without first learning to comprehend the language and know the characters as it is written. What are those? It is written in mathematical language, and its characters are triangles, circles, and other geometric figures, without which it is impossible to humanly understand a word. Without these, one is wandering in a dark labyrinth. Now, notice that the idea of a book, seen here, is, I think, connected in his thinking to the idea of an author. He's thinking there is an author to this book. Books are things that are written by an author. And he's thinking we need to figure out how this author wrote this book, in what language the author wrote it. When we want to read a book, one of the things we need to ask ourselves is what the genre is, what the language is. If we don't know the language, we're going to be completely lost. If we don't know the genre, we're going to be really confused. You know, you read a physics textbook and you think it's fantasy. You're going to be confused. Or you read a fantasy book or a science fiction book and you think it's science. Again, you're going to be confused. But you'll also be confused in other ways if you think, you know, you read historical fiction as history or and so on, or even read the historical fiction as science fiction. You'll be confused. You need to figure out what kind of thing you're reading. Until you know these things, you don't understand the book. Galileo's insight is that God is writing the book of the world in the language of mathematics. And specifically, though he doesn't say it here, I think it's the language of elegant and beautiful mathematics. And that's also important for Galileo in his embracing of Copernicus's a worldview. I think the success of the scientific revolution depended on two things. One, that people in the scientific revolution, like Galileo, believed that there was a creator who loved beautiful mathematics, and that they were right, that there was such a creator. So elegant mathematics is useful on this picture because God chose to create the world embodying it. Why did he do that? Because it's beautiful. And beauty is good, and God is good. But there are many good things that God could have done in the world. He could have made a world that is beautiful in a kind of baroque way that has no deep mathematical patterns, or maybe has no simple mathematical patterns, very complex ones. He could have done that. But that's not what he did. And I think in the Scientific Revolution, we realized what the genre of the Book of the World is. It's a book written in the language of mathematics with a great preference for simplicity and elegance. If this is right, then atheists who are engaged in science are cutting the branch they are sitting on. Because the reason why all this beautiful mathematics works, why the simpler theory, why the simpler formulas are to be preferred to more complex ones, is that it matches the aesthetic that God is embodying in the world. So if these thoughts are right, then theism, the belief that there is a God, allows one to say a couple of things about mathematics. That it's true because it describes ideas in the mind of God. That it's knowable because God created us. That it's beautiful because God is beautiful. That it's useful because it applies to the world. And it applies to the world because God wrote the Book of the World in that language. That was God's artistic choice. And took us a long time, 100,000 years or more, to figure out that that was God's artistic choice. And we are trying various other ways of reading it. Maybe it's a world full of spirits, and it's some kind of more like a fantasy story. We tried that for a long time. Our ancestors did it, and it didn't really work very well. And finally, around the time of Copernicus and Galileo, we got it. Logic, broadly speaking, describes the otherwise unlimited power of God. And then I could say this. Look, this gives us a theory that explains many things about mathematics. What makes it true? What makes it knowable? What makes it beautiful? What makes it useful? And it's a pretty elegant theory. It just supposes one being, one perfect being, God, to make the theory work out. I think, again, applying this scientific thought, that elegant theories that explain a lot of things are likely to be true. So there is a God. This is an argument this is similar to an argument that Leibniz, one of the inventors of the calculus, made in the 17th century, that we can argue to the existence of God from mathematics. He probably wouldn't have just said it's likely true. He would have expressed much more certainty on the basis of this argument. I mean, I have more certainty in God's existence, but this argument, I'll just say, gives you probability. Because there are other ways of explaining these things. But I think the God way has a unified explanation of all these different features of mathematics. And that, I think, is really cool. Thank you.
Take
10 to 15 minutes of questions. So, yeah, how about it?
Okay,
let's see. In the blue jacket.
So, much like Darwin's theory about evolution suggests that there are many models of organisms that just didn't make it up to the present day, and that we're just looking at a very small fraction of the organisms that have ever lived. Could we be possibly experiencing a selection bias in the same way as to the rules that govern the universe? Mm. So, in other words, is it possible that many different universes have been created with all the different fundamental parameters changed slightly, mm-hmm. and the only one that really was able to harbor intelligent life like ourselves just so happens to also make a lot of other patterns possible?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's actually something attractive about this picture that all the combinations of parameters are realized, say. That seems an elegant theory. if and so I think it has a lot going for it, even on the kinds of theistic grounds that I give. That seems like something that a God who's both who's generous and who loves beauty could want to do. But your question is more like, is there, as a way of challenging this thought, this line of thought that there's something special about our the beauty that we see in mathematics? And the suggestion is, well, in the universes that do not exhibit mathematical beauty, in those universes, intelligent life is unable to evolve. The parameters for those universes are not so good. I think this isn't quite right, because if the picture is we are varying the fundamental parameters in the laws of nature, like the numerical parameters, if that's what we're varying, then we're actually going to, then all the universes are actually going to be governed by the same equations with different constants. All these equations are going to be more or less equally beautiful, you know. I mean, this isn't a good example because C is just an arbitrary unit thing, but think of E equals mc squared, okay? So that's a lovely equation. Think of a world where C has a different value from the one it has in our world. It's just as beautiful an equation in that world as in ours, even though C has a different value. So I think if all that's being varied are these parameters in the equations, then I think they're all going to be beautiful. If we're varying the equations themselves, I don't see any reason to think that the simpler ones are good ones where it's more likely to get intelligent life. I mean, you could have, here's one that gives intelligent life just as well as ours. The equations are exactly the same as our universe's equations for t less than the year 3000, and for t after the year 3000, the equations are exactly as Newton said. Which is false. That would work just as well for evolution, because everything's the same up to now, and then things suddenly change. Or suddenly, you've got the equations of Ptolemaic astronomy holding in the year 3000. So there are lots of very complicated things, equations that switch, how they function at different times. And we could get evolution of intelligent beings in those just as well as in our world. Okay, question here.
Oh, yeah, thank you. I'm wondering your thoughts on God speaking in other languages as opposed, in addition to mathematical languages, logical languages, because it seems like also in this tradition of thought, it's taken that scripture is a language and therefore the thought of God, so it seems like he also speaks the language of scripture. And so I'm wondering your thoughts about
Good.
Does math, logic have a special, you know, place in God's thinking and language, or is it kind of one among others?
So one of the things I realized, we have this little faith and science group where two philosophers attend and a bunch of scientists and a few other people. And one of the things I realized this fall is that the biologists have a very different picture of what counts as a beautiful theory. It is not, they don't look for this kind of deep mathematical simplicity in the way that the physicists do. And I think Galileo was thinking mostly of physics. I don't think he was thinking of deep mathematical rules underlying biology. Maybe he would have thought that maybe you can reduce the biology in some way to physics, though I have no idea if such ideas were at all in the air at that time. I mean, slightly later, Descartes has those ideas, but Galileo, I don't know that he would. So I think he may have been just thinking about physics. So it could well be that different areas of the universe, or maybe different levels, we could say, are written in different languages. Maybe the greatest emphasis on mathematical beauty maybe is in the writing of the physics, and somewhat less in the chemistry, but still quite a lot of it. And then maybe God is more of a poet when he writes history, or sociology, or psychology.
So languages have levels of language, and there's baby talk in English. Let's just take English as baby talk, and then there's adult language, and then and the scriptures talk about the at least mentioned once that I know of the tongues of men and of angels. So what would the tongues of angels be like? And so this can all be one line of language that God has access to that we're just barely we're just barely getting. And it doesn't have those artificial linguistic divisions in the same way that life can be just life. And then we look at it and we think, oh, that's, you know, fish life, and this is some other kind of life, but it's all coming from life. So that beauty can, well, I sort of lost my train of thought, but that beauty can be much more reaching from a fundamental beginning that God gets that we don't get.
That could well be the case, and the problem of ugly mathematics could be also the ugly parts of mathematics could be also related to that. The other thing is that the biologists they're not, I think, dismissing beauty. They just have a different. For instance, the kind of beauty they're after has more diversity in it than while the physicists want to have more unity. Let's see, this is really hard. I can't remember the order at all. So let me take two more questions on this side, then move to the center, and then move to the left side. So you.
Yeah. Can you explain a little bit how Gödel's discoveries fit in with this idea of math as in the mind of God and logic as describing the power of God?
So... The simplest version is going to be a way that where it fits in is that Gödel discovered that there are truths of mathematics that cannot be proved. And he proved it. So it sounds kind of contradictory, but you have to understand, right, the point is in any particular system of axioms satisfying some conditions, there are going to be things that you cannot prove from those axioms. And so in particular, for any set of axioms you list for arithmetic, there are going to be some things that are true of or that are not provable from those, not disprovable from those, and yet presumably they're either true or false. So they're going to be either true or false. Now, I guess here we can say, well, so those kinds of things will not be accessible to us. Things that cannot be proved will not be accessible to us through proof. They will be accessible to God if mathematics is all about God's ideas by introspection. Namely, God can just see what he's thinking. And they might be accessible to us through other methods, like intuition, that other methods, because maybe God creates us and gives us other methods of accessing some of these things. So, for example, people working in set theory consider all sorts of axioms, and they've got nice theorems that if set theory is consistent, then this axiom can neither be proved nor disproved from these. But they have intuitions about some of them. So there are some set theorists who really think large cardinal axioms are clearly true. I don't have that intuition myself, but they do. And you know, this could all fit into this kind of story. It could well be that God sees in his ideas what the real truth of the matter is, and then gives people intuitions, maybe somewhat foggy ones, and they can maybe have some access that goes to mathematical truths that goes beyond proof.
Thank you for your talk. So, taking that math is uncontroversial, and then looking at something controversial in the Middle Ages was the problem of universals.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have nominalism and realism, and St. Augustine here seems to, well, what we brought up about St. Augustine, he seems to have kind of a Platonic realism, but mm-hmm. now the realm of the forms is the mind of God.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering if you can take something uncontroversial, such as mathematics,
to resolve that big controversy about the universals, because, you know, is there a way to do that and say, well, mathematics wouldn't be possible if these universals, the numbers, were not actually real, independent of human beings' minds?
Yeah. Could be. I mean, that's kind of the approach that this talk suggests. But there might be some other theories that will work, too. I like certain way nominalist approaches to mathematics that go through the power of God. I have it not so much about the ideas in the mind of God, but about the power of God and what God can create. That's a different approach than the historical one we got in Augustine. This is kind of an observation that Alvin Plantinga has made, which is that you can have theories that have serious problems, and then you put God into them. Now, there are maybe problems with the concept of God, but you put God into them, and their problems disappear. So you have like various mind-dependent theories of things. And then you put God into it, and suddenly, if it's depending on God's mind, now you've got objectivity, because it's one. There's a privileged mind. So it could well be that nominalists, that while here I sketched a theistic realist view, there's a theistic nominalist view, which has the ability to overcome some of the problems with the nominalist and non-theistic views as well. And I have some thoughts in that direction as well. Let's move to the middle section. Yeah.
Yeah, logic, broadly speaking, describes the otherwise unlimited power of God. And I think that that's arising from the slide about Aquinas. But problem with the word otherwise, right? Because if we're talking about a God who is omnipotent, there's no reason why this God could not do what is illogical or supra-rational. Why should logic in any way confine the unlimited potentiality from expressing in ways completely beyond anything we could conceive of, using even the most brilliant?
So Aquinas says this. He says, the New Testament says God can do any word. That's often translated as anything, but he notes that the Greek is literally any word. God can do, I guess he has the Latin. He wasn't good at Greek, actually. God can do any word. And he says, but the contradictory thing is not a word. And I think what he's thinking there is that
You can make the noise, God could make a square circle, but you are not speaking. You haven't said anything when you said this. What is this thing, a square circle? Is it like this? Is it like this? It seems like it's nonsense to just say it. And so I think he's thinking, when you attribute the possibility of doing an illogical thing to God, you're not even saying anything. I think that's his thought. Now, whether that's successful, you know, is a question to be asked. You know, Descartes thought that God creates the laws of logic. That's a different view from Aquinas. I guess then you could say maybe God chose really beautiful laws of logic as the first choice and then made everything else cohere with that. I don't like that. I think Aquinas is right. There's not a word when you say these things, these contradictory things. And so you haven't said anything when you've said that God can do those things.
Just one more question, and then we're going to wrap up.
Okay. Let's go with you.
You said earlier that in your slide describing science, that scientists tend to prefer simpler theories. And you also said that if it's only for the sake of convenience, then we shouldn't trust science. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little more on that, because I think that a scientist would say that we tend to prefer simpler theories because they are more easily utilizable for future science and future experiments. And it is sort of a puzzle why it's able to be successful at all, but the reason we trust that is simply because of induction in a way, like that when we do it, it just happens to work. So I'm wondering if that's really what your point boils down to, that, or there's something deeper with this point.
Okay, so... Well, first of all, I mean, it's just kind of an... I guess it is... Y equals X is a little simpler to work with than this, but it seems a very contingent thing. I mean, we could imagine that you have a calculator that's optimized for this polynomial and works less well for the other one. We could build those, and then this would be just as convenient as that, and yet still that wouldn't be what science goes for. I mean, when we do induction, right? I mean, the induction is a... variant on curve fitting, right? So you do induction, and so you're doing, okay, so if x is 0.5, y is around 0.5, if x is 1, y is around 1, if x is 1.5, y is around 1.5. And you think, okay, so by induction, what's it going to be? Well, it's really figuring out what's the best curve, right? And so you do this induction, say, well, what's it going to be for 3.5? And now the exact fit and the line diverge heavily, right, at 3.5, we get exactly 3.5 on the straight line, and for the curve, it's something really big, like 7 or something. I don't really know. And so what your inductive prediction is, you can make a prediction using both of these equations just as well. The one that scientists actually, if you're going to ask them, what is the inductive inference you should make from this? What do you think it will be when you get to 3.5? They will, I think, invariably go with the straight line. Now, they will say, of course, they're not sure. All these things are highly fallible. We make mistakes sometimes. Sometimes the more complicated thing is true. But they're going to be quite fairly confident that it's not the polynomial that goes through these points exactly. Now, maybe you could say, maybe we've just done this meta-induction. So we've seen that simpler theories have worked in the past for predicting things better than these more complicated theories. And so we go for the simpler ones because that's been a success. I don't actually know that it has been actually that much of a success. When Copernicus's original theory wasn't more predictive than the Ptolemaic one, so I don't know. I don't.
But I mean, speaking of this particular example, I mean, a scientist could concede that it's actually the x to the 4 polynomial. It's just that when we do an experiment, it's often very noisy, and so you just want to start with a linear model, and you have these higher order corrections which you will ignore because it's practically too hard to distinguish them from a straight line.
But look, you just get this data in the lab, and then somebody comes and says, offers you some gambles, you know, says, okay, all right, now look, if you can predict within 0.5 what the next data point's going to be, I will pay you $100, and if you don't predict it right, I'm going to torture you. So a lot rides on this for you, right? You're going to guess. You're just going to go with the straight line. And it's not because it's easier to use. It's because you think it's more likely to get you off the hook and get you the $100 rather than being tortured. So I think the scientist is actually thinking. It's not just they will go to a lab back and check. That's the prediction they're living with. And I mean, we do this. I mean, we have a lot more data points, but we have the physics in airplanes, and we're happy to get into the airplanes that are built on the simpler models rather than the more complex ones.
Okay, let's take a break.